help leverage loans to pay off debts, add a television channel exclusively for WBAI, continue much of the programming you value, provide trainings for all WBAI producers, house WBAI at MNN state-of-the-art studios, dramatically reduce our on-air fundraising days, provide support for off-air fundraising, provide a fair process for program evaluation, be limited in time as per a contract that staff and listeners would have input on, and finally, allow MNN to broaden its own profile by adding WBAI's quality programming on both radio and TV while fulfilling its mission to build media collaborations. So if you want to tell the Pacifica board that we want to keep our 99.5 signal and make decisions on WBAI's future transparently, visit www.change.org and search for WBAI Swap. You can also email the board directly at pnb@pacifica.org. That's pnb@pacifica.org, and demand that they speak with MNN's manager, who himself is a former head of Pacifica and embodies WBAI's community-involved principles, about the possibilities for building a partnership with WBAI. And that's my perspective. This is Bob Lederer signing off for Health Action. I want to thank our engineer, Reggie Johnson.
On November 9th, people from around the world came together to celebrate the life and times of Kate Millett. Joy of Resistance was there. And this Sunday, December 3rd, 6 to 7 p.m., we will share recordings of this event with you. Millett was a lifelong rebel. She exposed the sexism of male literary icons in her 1970 feminist classic, Sexual Politics. She traveled to Iran to join women fighting religious fundamentalism. She was an anarchist and an artist who lived on the Bowery and sold Christmas trees for a living even after she was famous. At her memorial, Yoko Ono spoke, Holly Near sang, and Hillary Clinton sent a message. This Sunday, 6 to 7 p.m., join the celebration of this wayward American original, Kate Millett. Don't miss it.
You are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Justin Key, a name you may not know yet. Good morning. So, as is typical, right after I announce that I've got a guest, I do all the talking. And I am going to, for the first few minutes, if you are on Facebook and want to watch the proceedings of the show, or at least half of them, see Justin Key, because I don't do the two-way camera thing, you are most welcome to by going, I think... You have to go to my timeline, to Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and you will see it happening there. I don't do it in the Hour of the Wolf Group because my timeline is public. In the Hour of the Wolf Group, you have to join. And I rather just, you know, have this be fully available to the world. I'll post it to the Hour of the Wolf Group after. But for now, there it is. And why was I saying? Oh, yes, yeah, so... Go on Facebook, and you will now bear in mind that the audio of the broadcast will not be in sync with the Facebook. There can be as much as 30 to 45 seconds apart. This is called internet lag. So, coffee. But the thing that I find very weird is that I have been told by people who are watching the Facebook feed, that the Facebook comes through before the radio broadcast. And I find that very strange indeed. I suspect I know why. And one of these years, I'll bring it up to the powers that be. But as you can hear from the previous show, if nothing else, that is the least of the worries that the station has. And by the way, we should partner with nobody, let me tell you. And a signal swap in the days of the internet is not the end of the world. We aren't getting enough listeners in the middle of the FM dial now. If we can get a whole bunch of money stuffed into our pocket for taking a lower frequency and building podcasts and things like that, we will be a stronger WBAI rather than have somebody who, in my opinion, would not have the best interests of WBAI at heart and who's been trying to basically take hold of the station for 15, 20 years. No. I totally disagree. So do not let the fact that board member said that. The other person who shares that time slot, Catherine Davis, is a board member and totally disagrees. And so do I. So anyway, I don't know about she agrees or disagrees with the signal swap, but we know that teaming up with somebody else which is in essence a takeover rather than a merge. And if we had to merge, there are better people you could merge with. Anyway, enough of that. I don't like doing station politics on the air. I like talking about science fiction and stuff like that there. And that starts with promoting my own thing. That is to say that this coming Tuesday, December 5th, really? Tuesday is December already? Okay, so usually December 5th, December reading of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings has for about the last dozen years or so have always been Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner. And they decided after, you know, somebody blithely offered them a year for free living in a chateau in France that they would rather do that. Well, you're probably listening to me right now. It's morning in France. That just means, Ellen and Delia, that we're going to have to go ahead without you. And we chose a program that I know that the two of you will enjoy. Sarah Pinsker is not only a brilliant writer, she is the author of, I'll do the formal bios. Sarah Pinsker is the author of the Nebula Award-winning novelette, Our Lady of the Open Road. Oh, it's a great story. And the Theodore Sturgeon Award-winning novelette, Enjoy, Knowing the Abyss Behind. Her stories have appeared in Asimov, Strange Horizons, Fantasy and Science Fiction, Lightspeed, I got to edit the podcast for Lightspeed, and Uncanny, among others, and in anthologies including Long Hidden and The New Voices of Fantasy. She is also, by no small coincidence, a singer-songwriter and has toured nationally behind three albums on various independent labels. That's how you know she's a professional. She uses language like she has toured behind three albums. That's like, yeah, okay. That's gig talk there. That's the real thing, people. A fourth album is forthcoming. She lives with her wife and dog in Baltimore, Maryland. You can find her online at sarahpinsker.com and on Twitter at SARAHPINKSTER. Good enough, huh? That's the opening act. Now, I shouldn't say that, because actually Sarah was the first person booked and all that. The second person should be of, isn't a person, it's an act, as it were. Catherine M. Valenti. Not small change either, folks. Kat Valenti is the New York Times bestselling author of over two dozen works of fiction and poetry, including Palimpsest, the Orphan's Tale series, which we have broadcast on this program and had at the... We actually did a recording of the Orphan's Tale stories and music from it on board a ship at the South Street Seaport. That was an event to remember. Deathless, Radiance, and the crowd-funded phenomenon The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Making, and the four books that followed it. She is the winner of the Andre Norton Tiptree Sturgeon Prize Imaginale Yugi Foster Memorial Mythopoeic Riesling Lambda Locus Romantic Critics Circle Choice and Hugo Awards. It's a list. She has been a finalist for the Nebula and World Fantasy Award. She lives on an island off the coast of Maine with a small but growing menagerie of beasts, some of which are human. She'd be, so that's this coming Tuesday. Oh, and what Kat is doing. Heath Miller will be the host. Kat is the inventor and cause for our having a quiz show, a game show. Sort of in the British style, sort of like QI or some of those shows they have there. And I saw her do this at ReaderCon, and it was a hoot and a holler. Well, we're bringing it to New York next Tuesday. It's got a very clever title, which I've forgotten now. And Kat is... Heath Miller is the game show host, as it were. Kat is the constant contestant. So if you watch QI, where Stephen Fry was, and I'm blanking the name of the Norwegian woman who's now the host. She's very good. Alan Davis is a contestant every week, and the others rotate with different people. So there are two people, one of whom will be Sarah Pinsker from the first act, and Kat, because she thought this up, and some cool person that Kat hasn't told me yet who it will be, or Heath hasn't told me who it will be. But that's what we're doing. Admission is free. Donations are very much requested. And it's here at not WBAI, it's here at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue. Very, very easy to get to. There are more trains that come here than go to Times Square. That is a fact. Even the Long Island Railroad stops here at the Barclays Center, about five long blocks away. But it's very easy to get to 388 Atlantic Avenue, and I'll be hosting, and I hope to see you then. And hopefully Ellen and Delia will be watching it on live stream. And if you're outside of New York City, you can watch it live on live stream or after the fact on live stream, just like you can watch this show now on Facebook Live. And live stream has been sold. It's now part of Vimeo. I think they're going to call it Vimeo Live. But this week, it's live stream. So there you are. And again, that's this coming Tuesday, 7 p.m., December 5th, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Sarah Pinsker, and then Kat Valenti and Heath Miller, and be here. It's going to be very festive, a lot of music, a lot of fun. And by no small coincidence, since Kat will be in town, she'll be the guest on this program next week. Okay, that's enough for now. There isn't... No, there isn't a KGB Fantastic Fiction reading next week, so I'm not missing an announcement for them, for the evil competition to my reading series. They are brilliant and very, very good, but because they are evil, run by people like Ellen Datlow, who was on this program 2 weeks ago, and will be on the air again sometime in December with her new Alice in Wonderland book, and the anthology of new stories all based in Wonderland. And Matt Kressel, who was on this show, about a month ago, because if you're going to talk about Blade Runner, you're going to have to talk with Matt Kressel. And that's exactly what we did. Anyway, that was then. This is now. Justin Key is our guest. He sent me a lovely bio, which I somehow neglected to put at hand, but you can... So let's start by making sure that you're on mic. Say hello.
Hello.
Oh, that sounds decent. Welcome, Justin. It's very cool to have you here. It is fair to say you are not yet a name writer, although you've certainly published.
It's definitely fair.
You've been published in what we in the know called FNSF, but to other people, to real people, is the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction.
Yes.
And what other stories have you been pubbed in?
So also...
Stories books. Sorry.
And cross genres. So.
And excellent.
Yeah. So I had a story out in that about 2 years ago, The Tear Collector.
Uh-huh.
Still be found online. And also a relatively new publication at the time that I got in there was Kaiso Flash, and it stands for Kick Your Socks Off Flash. And
is that Flash fiction?
Yes.
Okay.
I couldn't tell.
And their definition for Flash, many people have different definitions for Flash.
So mine, I think it was capped at 1,000 words, the one that I sent in.
Okay.
And I remember when they first sent it back to me, it was a little bit over 1,000, and they were like, we really want to take this, but we have kind of strict guidelines. So, and they're not only speculative, but the story that I sent them was speculative, and they were they really liked it. So
fair enough. There is Some people have flash fic as being under 500 words. Mm-hmm. Some do page count. Orally, some do under 3 minutes, which is how I define it, because mm-hmm. I've had this dream, and I should talk to you about it, of creating all these different little stories that we can have available for anybody on any program to use. Sure, you can play a cut of music, but why not play a piece of fiction while you're taking a break between one show and another or whatever? And I have about 3 or 4 currently on cycle, but I don't think anybody plays them. I've got Michael Swanwick doing Storyteller Rock, and another one that I produced by Frederick Brown, and a Thomas M. Dish story, Fun With Your New Head, a great story. So, I love flash fic.
3 minutes, about how many words is that?
Let's see. I would guess about 800.
Okay.
You know, but and you don't want to talk
it's
fast.
A flash story.
You really don't want to talk fast. Yeah, but 300 minutes, 3 minutes is a nice length.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it can be 3.5. I'm not counting the
flexible
seconds. Yeah. Yeah. People ask, you know, how long do I have to read this story? And I go to an old, probably apocryphal quote about Abraham Lincoln, where somebody supposedly asked him, how tall do you have to be? You know, should a person be? Because he was a tall man. And he would say, tall enough so that your legs will reach the floor. And so how long should this story be? And the answer is long enough to get to the end.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah. So, oh, now I can see on Facebook, I couldn't see the comments. I couldn't see the chats. And I love watching the chats.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole fascinating medium there, because it's not just that people can chat while we're on the air, but they could watch this tomorrow, and they can comment tomorrow, and we can still go online tomorrow and respond. So it like keeps on happening. It's sort of like Ted Chiang's Story of Your Life or the movie Arrival. There is no time.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good connection. You actually kind of blew my mind a little bit with that one.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, that's I've been admiring this as a new medium.
Well, I can't.
Somebody
see it.
Asks, so what kind of fiction does he write, Barbara?
So
you okay, Barbara? You don't, no comment, lady. Okay, yeah, sorry. This is you are in the same writers. You're in Tableau Rasa, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so yes. You are in the same writers group as the aforementioned Barbara.
Yes.
And Richard Bowes and so forth. So Barbara would like to know, so what kind of fiction does he write?
Well, Barbara, thank you for asking. So mainly speculative, and to get more specific, I'd say mainly what I write is science fiction. I've been, just as a background, I've been in a medical career for the past several years. I just finished medical school, so it's kind of like something that comes a little bit more natural to me in terms of looking up those topics. The story that I'm going to read today isn't a science fiction story. It's more fantasy, alternate history fiction.
Which to me is all in the same genre.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whether it's science fiction or fantasy or alternate history or horror, Damon Knight had a famous definition. Science fiction is what I'm pointing at. I like that definition. And one time I had somebody come on the air, read a brilliant short story, and there was nothing fantastic about it in the literal sense of fantastic. And somebody called up and said, how is that science fiction? And I said, did you like the story? And they said, well, yeah. And they said, good enough, Clint. So it is what it is.
Yep.
It's one of the few times I'll accept that statement. Carol says, I've heard one of his readings and enjoyed the, and I've got the bracket in the way. Enjoyed
that,
them, I
that
think.
That sounds positive. I'll take that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So you are, as so many people, a Clarion grad.
I am. Yep. Clarion West, 2015.
Wow. Okay. So who were the, now Clarion, for those who don't know, is the school, the writer's workshop to really launch professional SF writers or wannabes. But I would say that's an extremely high turnout of people who attend Clarion. It's not easy to get into to begin with. To people who start selling their work not long after without even their saying, I'm a Clarion graduate, although saying that doesn't hurt. Who are your and it rotates. It's a six-week workshop.
Yes.
So who are your teachers?
So 6 weeks, one teacher for every week. We started off with Andy Duncan, who was like the father bear to our group for the 6 weeks.
That's a great description for him. Yeah.
And we also had Eileen Gunn. We had Tobias Buckle. We had Susan Powick. We had Nalo Hopkinson. Nalo Hopkinson and Corey Doctorow.
Wow. That's as usual.
Those are great 6 weeks.
That's a great lineup. I mean, and every single one of them has been on this show at one time or another. Yeah, excellent company. Andy Duncan is just genius and such a genteel yet very, very aware character.
Yes.
And Nalo is one of the geniuses in the field who somehow hasn't yet been fully grasped and appreciated by the wider world at large, but she will be. People go back from her first novel, Brown Girl in the Ring, to everything after, including some of her short fiction, and so on and so forth. Everybody in there. And Cory Doctorow, of course, is somebody who is a disruptor.
He is
in there to make you think.
Yes. It was a very good combination, not just of the instructors, of also the class, just the very, I think, distinctly being able to retrospectively say that I learned something distinct from everybody. So it was really, really a beneficial experience for me and kind of an enlightening experience as well. Not just for writing, but just in life.
Yeah.
In terms of just knowing people that have life experience that I wouldn't even imagine before, and just being in that intimate space just did a lot for me, not just as a writer, but even as a person, mm-hmm. I'd say.
Yeah. It's 6 weeks with how many people in the workshop?
18.
18?
Yep.
Okay, that's good, because sometimes it's been as large as 30.
Wow.
So when Margo Adler took it, it was about 30 people. And that was 1972 or 3. And when you're spending 6 intense weeks formulating what is to be much of your career in the future...
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be a life changer, and the people around you. Sam Miller refers to the people in his year as crib mates. Oh, what year? He wasn't in your year.
He was 2012, I believe.
Okay.
At San Diego, and I know this because he helped with my application for 2015. It's a funny story. My wife went to business school with a good friend of his. And my wife's friend had read my application for 2012 Clarion West when George R. R. Martin was applying. And she just happened to know that also, oh, my friend is applying to something like that as well. And a few years later, when I decided to apply again, I put in contact, and he was very encouraging on my application and the stories. that I sent in, and we've kept in touch since.
Oh, very good. And he's a good correspondent. Yeah, he's very good. I shouldn't say that. He and I corresponded when he lived in Hoboken and hung out in Brooklyn. That was many years ago. But you know, if I was on Live Journal more, mm-hmm. we'd probably be corresponding more. How would you, expanding on what Barbara was asking, tell us a little more about what drives you to be writing speculative fiction or other fiction in the fantastic realms as opposed to mystery or wiggling his fingers, mainstream fiction?
I think that it's one of those things that really kind of has its roots in something that I couldn't describe as a child, just in terms of devouring books as a kid. And, you know, and many people have this story, like being able to be taken to other places. And I think that when my mind would wander, or when I would think about the world or how it works, I would kind of think about, okay, well, what if it worked this way? Or what if these rules were changed? Or, you know, this is something that I just learned about the world. What if this were different, this fundamental rule? Like, what kind of story would that make? So I think that's always been something that's kind of fascinated me on an intellectual level. And I think in terms of storytelling, it, for me, I've always been drawn very much to how different characters react to other characters and the situations that they're put in. And I think that with speculative fiction, it's, you can have just, you know, you can change all these rules and create all these different worlds, and then at the end of the day, it's still, for me, about how the characters react to that, mm-hmm. and how they react to that world. And I think it's just something very, very appealing to me, and I can't really put my finger on it, to be honest, about doing that in a setting that's kind of different from, in some fundamental way, from the reality that we're in now. So it's always been a draw. Like I write from time to time. I will find myself writing stories that don't fall into the speculative realm, and it'll be just because that's where my mind is taking me at that moment. But usually, in terms of
when it's still going to be a Justin Key story.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had people come on the show and apologize and say, "Well, this isn't really speculative fiction," and I'll say, "Yeah, well, yeah, well." It's still going to be a Justin Key story, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
You know, just because it ain't SF.
Right.
Doesn't, you know, it's still in the same genre. The genre is it was written by this writer. That writer might have different, you know, Picasso, blue period, cubist mm-hmm. period. Still a bleeping Picasso.
Right, right.
So... What stories or what writers were you, or what things were you doing? See, I come from enough old school that I say, what were you reading? But in the case of some people like Nora Jemison, N.K. Jemison, the question was, what video games were you playing? Because that was her entree, role-playing games, both video and variants on D&D. That's what brought her into the fantastic realms. So my old school thinking, I can't just ask, what were you reading? But having said that, what were you reading? Or what were you playing? What were you doing that brought you to writing and to the genre?
So if we are going to talk about what originally brought me, it's not as sophisticated, but it was when I was very young. And I think that I remember when I was originally introduced to just reading and reading and reading and devouring books, honestly, was when I was maybe about 6 or 7, and it was the Goosebumps series, actually. And now that I think about it, in terms of like every one of those stories was a little snippet of the fantastical. And it was, I think, that what you kind of got my mind around, okay, what possibilities are there in like changing some of the rules in this world. And I think that even as a kid around that time, like I wrote something for class and it was called The Butterfly Chronicles, I think. And it was about this this
I like
guy.
The title.
Yeah. and I believe it was this guy who would be reincarnated as different animals. And I remember I had illustrations and we did this project in school where we threaded it to make it into like an actual book. So I think that was the beginning of the time when I was around, like, I really like reading, you know, what I like creating as well. As I got older, I read a lot of Stephen King. And I know one of the main things that I started writing in is horror, you know, in terms of the fiction. When I first started writing fiction seriously, it was horror. And I think that one of the big motivators for that was Stephen King's work. And as I said before, what I was really drawn to was how he had very real characters and just how they responded to, you know, very horrible circumstances. And sometimes the characters would really be the ones that create these, create the horror of the stories. And also around the same time, I was reading a lot of Michael Crichton. And I remember as a young person, just reading his books and feeling like I learned a lot, like, from just even about, I remember reading Jurassic Park, and for example, this is a random snippet, but learning that male lions, when they come in on a new pride, they might kill all the cubs.
That's right.
To put the lioness into heat, so that all of the progeny is hit, are his.
Yeah,
and I forget exactly what. Well, they'll
be part
Park.
Of a coalition. Yeah. I know way too much about. Yeah. Because at this very moment, actually, no, it should just have ended. At this very moment in South Africa and in Kenya, in the Maasai Mara, a safari that's broadcast 6 hours a day on YouTube. Mm-hmm. The morning session just ended. It goes either from 10 p.m. to 1:30 a.m. in New York. And the sunset safari should start at about 8 a.m. in the morning. And I watch this incessantly. This, to me, is reality television, and it is. It's live. And you learn, you see the lions, you watch them, and you watch these professional guides and conservationists, mm-hmm. and they tell you all about it, and I'm hooked. So for anybody else, just, you know, Safari Live, or go mm-hmm. to wildearth.tv on the web, and you it's dangerous. You too will be hooked. But yeah, so I know all about, that's exactly what happens. Pride is usually just all females. Mm-hmm. And then you have a coalition of lions who may service a wider area that can have, anywhere from 2 to 5 prides. And if they've taken over from another coalition, they will very often do just that. They will kill the cubs, and sometimes they will kill some of the lionesses if they put up too much resistance, because lioness, they're there to protect the cub.
Right.
And if they're not totally compliant, well, then, yeah, that they can get killed. Mm-hmm. And killing the cubs puts the lionesses all into estrus, is the word that the rangers and guides out in Africa like to use. And then the lions impregnate as many of the females as they can, and there's a whole new litter. And the coalition, as long as it's another member, you know, there can be 2 to 5 lions in a coalition, and they won't kill the progeny of another member of the coalition, unless they don't recognize it. And lions are dumb. Leopards are smart. Lions are dumb. They can kill their own cubs and not know it.
And see, I learned that as a kid in a Michael Crichton book. Not as in much detail, but it stayed with me. And I remember thinking, you know, at some point wanting to take what I was learning and trying to present it to people in a way that, in an engaging way, that it was presented to me. Like, I didn't even realize that I was learning things in these books until after the fact.
Yeah.
You know, until later, I was like, oh, I remember that. I didn't. The book was about something.
There's medicine in that, honey.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff. So much can be didactic without its ever intending to be. Octavia Butler had that capability that she could write just an adventure.
Yeah.
And you read it, and it was just an adventure until you realized that the next week you were still thinking about that. And then all of a sudden it's like, wait, let me reread that.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden it's like, whoa, there is content here.
Yeah.
There's didacticism that you didn't realize was there.
Yeah.
And she did that very, very well. Talent of the Sours, not as much as Parable of the Sours. Somebody's doing an opera, by the way, of Parable of the Sours being performed in New York in January. I have to get more information on that. But there's a book to turn into an opera.
Just January? Do you know who's going to be in it?
Let's see if I get her name right. One of the movers and shakers of Sweet Honey in the Rock. Mm-hmm. Is it Bernice Regan is her name, I think?
You would know better than me.
Okay, well, it's not a full staging. It will be sort of a concert version. Let me see if I can Google it. Parable of the Sours Opera. Okay. Toshi Regan. And Toshi Regan. Wow. Okay. This is so for more information, listeners, go to parableopera.com and that will tell you about it. And in this genre-defying work of political theater featuring a powerhouse ensemble of 20 singers and musicians, not a full staging, but they'll have all the voices, Octavia E. Butler's Parable of the Sour harnesses 200 years of black music to give musical life to Butler's acclaimed science fiction novel of the same name. They should say more about Toshi Regan, because she is herself a force to reckon with. And and there are videos and stuff. Toshi Regan and Bernice Johnson Regan are the authors of the opera.
Okay.
So,
and that's also a very exciting part of writing or creating, is just thinking about how things can be reimagined, and in the context of, as time changes, can mean something different to a new generation. So it's very exciting that, her work is still is being brought to a new light and able to reach new audiences.
Well, there's also going to be a TV series based on one of her works, and I've forgotten what it is.
Yes, I knew it.
And Nora sold a TV series on the Inheritance trilogy. And Nannetti, help me with her last name.
I know how to spell it in my
head. Yeah, I can spell it. O-K-E-R-A. It's by Nannetti. Okay, if I just Google Nannetti, this is awful. And I met her at ReaderCon. O-K-O-A-F-O-R. So, Okorafor. It's actually not that hard once you say it a couple of times. Nannetti, that's N-N-E-D-Y, Nannetti. That much I know, because that's what I called her. I spoke with her at ReaderCon. Nannetti Okorafor. And she sold the Binti universe as a TV series. These are all no doubt going to be similar to what they've been doing of late, like with American Gods and things where they're not necessarily doing the novel. Mm-hmm. They're taking the universe and running around in the universe, being true, hopefully, to the author, but not necessarily doing the story that the author wrote. That's what they're doing with The Handmaid's Tale as well. Mm-hmm. Although I haven't seen that because it's Hulu. Hulu. Why? And people say, why are you like that about Hulu? Hulu is Fox. Just remember that, folks. That's all I got to say. I don't give money to Foxes. I feel guilty if I even watch Fox stuff. But their TV stuff is produced totally differently from anything that the Despicables of Fox are concerned. But still,
yeah,
I pay for enough other services. I don't need Hulu as well, but I do want to see The Handmaid's Tale very much.
It's well done, I'll say, if you can stomach Hulu.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're just the broadcaster. They're not the producers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so at least I don't think they're the producers. Usually a production company picks something up, they auction it off, and there it goes. Would you like to talk at all about how about your medical training and how and being a father and how how this has all informed your writing?
Well, I would say that I think there were three things that I wanted to be as a kid, and those three things were a doctor, a writer, and a family man. And
I'm wow.
Not making that up. I'm not lying about it. But those are the three things that I really enjoyed reading. I dressed up as a doctor for career day when I was in fourth grade, and I come from a single mother home. My mother was great, but you know, just lacking that full family. I was also like a only child. It's also something that I wanted to have. So that said, I had my sights set on both being a writer and also going to medical school. And I knew whatever I ended up doing, like career-wise, that I would want to continue writing, that I would want my life experience to inform my writing. So they were never... So, you know, a lot of times they might come into conflict with each other, especially... You know, medical school being a very time intensive.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Yeah,
it's nowadays I know few people who, from my mm-hmm. point of view, are relatively younger who are full doctors, and I think how do they get the time to write? I mean, the rigors of being a doctor, are well rigorous.
Well, I know that. So, for example, in 2007, when I was in college, I'd read Stephen King's On Writing, and he said that he writes every day. He even, and you know, he even says that in interviews, he said, for example, in interviews, I say I don't write on Christmas, but that's a lie. I do write on Christmas. I just wanted it to sound interesting. So, you know, I had that ingrained in me. Okay, you have to write every day, you have to write every day. And so it was stressful starting medical school because, and even applying to medical school before that, you know, writing every day, if I didn't do that, I felt like a failure. So what I had to be okay with was writing in spurts. And that was something that I would do in medical school, particularly. You know, it's very time intensive, but they do have down times. They do have periods of times when you might have break from the rigors of learning. You might have elective time, this or that. And actually, Clarion West was something that I did right in the middle of medical school.
Wow, so you were able to get 6 weeks that you were able to stay away from medical school for?
Yeah, and it kind of worked out well because I just finished my first 2 years of medical school. I had taken the boards for medical school, like that you take after the first 2 years. It's like this mega test. And then you start third years, which is you're in the hospital, and it's broken up into blocks. And they have the first week of the year is like orientation stuff, a lot of stuff that you can do online, to be honest. And then they have a 4-week block of elective time, and you can use that elective time however you want. Some people use it for vacation, and you just make up that your elective requirements in the fourth year when you have a lot more flexibility. Yeah. So there's 5 weeks right there, and I forget where the sixth week came from, but it was just right in the right time because Clarion West is like from June 21st to like the end of July. So, and the school year for medical school, the year starts right around July 1st. So it actually landed in a very good place.
A sweet spot, yeah.
Yeah, so where I was able to go, and you can ask my Clarion classmates, you know, we were keeping tabs of how many words were written, and I wrote the most. I wrote about 40,000 words while I was during the 6 weeks, and the second most was about 30,000 words. And I think that for me, it was like, okay, I might not have that much of an opportunity to write for this next year after I leave here, so let's see, you know, how productive I can be while I'm here. And that's not to say that I was just spewing out words, but it was, I think that there was a kind of a, almost a desperation in me in that time to try to get the most out of the experience, both in learning from the instructors and my peers, and also being productive in the stories that I had swimming around in my head.
Yeah. Now, speaking of which, you're going to be reading a piece today that's a novella.
A novelette.
So that's going to take a little while, so we should probably get to that.
Okay.
Let me tell listeners, by the way, or I should say viewers on Facebook, that if you have a question, like somebody posed a question that is on topic but involves, like I was talking about Fox TV, that's not relevant to what we're doing right now, I will answer it, but I'll answer it later, after I get off the air, or tomorrow, unless it's relevant right now. Now, would you like to take a brief break before you read, or do you want to dive in? We can take a cut of music if you like.
We can do a cut of music.
Okay, so here is a band. Last week, I played Shan Chakraborty was the guest. I played a couple of tunes from a wonderful band who I'd seen live in concert called Tribekistan. But I also discovered another band of a slightly similar nature called The Middle East Side. And here is a tune, Brooklyn Ballady. Brooklyn Ballady from the band The Middle East Side, from an album called Gin. It's not like gin and tonic, folks. It's D-J-I-N-N. You should know your creatures, your mythological or... Well, know your creatures, that's all. This is speaking of creatures, this is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. And this program, Hour of the Wolf, is also, you can watch the video of it on Facebook Live. I am Jim Freund. With me is Justin Key. And Justin is about to read a novelette, which is defined as how many words?
So this story is about 13,000 words.
So a novelette is like over 10,000? Is that
yes,
the deal?
Yes, I believe so, yes.
Okay. And and this requires a disclaimer. And the disclaimer is as follows, that the following story contains frank language, both of a exclamatory profanity nature as well as a racial slur within the context of the story. And we are in the safe harbor period, and we are allowed to do this, but it is incumbent upon me to warn you that this is not... What's the word? It's not safe. For some people, certain language could contain triggers that might anger people. And if you are one of those people, it is probably best that you tune out and rejoin us at 3 a.m. when, I'm not sure if Lister is going to be here. He told me last week that it was possible that Habte Selassie would be filling in, which would thrill me, because for about 15 years, Hour of the Wolf came after Habte's wonderful show, and I love preceding Lister, but I haven't seen Habte in so long, so that would be very cool. So, anyhow, disclaimer done, and title the story, and be sure to mention the copyright.
The title of the story is Afia's Song, and it was published in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, July-August 2017 of this year, and it is a story that I wrote the first draft of at Clarion West 2 years ago and revised after and then sent it in to FNSF, and they liked it. And I hope you will, too. I'll be reading a first portion of the story. So, all right. So, the setting is Hairston Plantation, Davie County, North Carolina, in 1821. The fields didn't sing for old Mr. Charles Hairston, who died choking on his own vomit during one of his whiskey fits in 1821. Not a single Negro eye wept. He'd run his plantation of over 100 slaves with a cold hand. His son, Louis Hairston, who had been living with his Uncle Willie up the road, came home with his new bride, Beatrice, to take over the land. Afia, a young field slave who had flung rocks at trees and collected yellow leaves with young Mr. Louis as a child, took 9 lashes on their second day running the plantation for sassing the new missus. As the whip cracked, she sang herself across the ocean to her ancestors' healing grounds of drums and wine and tea oil. Miss Beatrice, who most likely thought she had passed out, slapped her across the face and brought her back in time for the last crack of Harry the Overseer's whip. A pit of fire ripped open from Afia's shoulder to buttocks. She pulled it all inside of her like only a good Negro girl knows how and let some out when she reached her cabin. After a whipping, a slave had freedom to lay up in her cabin so she could be ready with the next morning sun. Even with the healing notes of her song, Afia usually took the rest to avoid suspicion, but this time she had fire in her blood. She returned to the field 2 hours later. "They touch you," James said. Though they had been married for almost a year now, she hadn't told him about her healing song. He was a comely Negro with acorn-colored eyes, full lips that sang when touched to hers, and a belly that wasn't too big but gave Afia something to hold on to. I swear, if they... You swears a lot, Afia said. Ain't no harm done. She exposed her back to him. See for yourself. James pulled her blouse down over her shoulders. What they keep you there for, then? To whip me? But I said, please, missus, don't whip me. I won't do it again. I'll be a good little Negro. They like stuff like that. They laughed. When James turned to a new cotton plant, Afia looked back toward the whipping tree. She could just see its branches. She'd tell James one day, when she was ready. The sky had been stingy for weeks. The cotton stalks were sharp as knives and left careless fingers bloody. Besides that, picking cotton was mindless work. Once a Negro got into the rhythm of breaking the stalk, turning it over, plucking the bough of leaves off the back, and stuffing it in the basket, staying on her feet was what took attention. In the worst parts of summer, the sun could bake a Negro inside out and put her on her knees, close to death, before she even knew she felt any kind of way. Miss Beatrice's silhouette stood watch over her stoop. The evening sun set right atop the Hairston mansion. The porch was covered in shadow. Still, Afia could feel the missus's eyes on her. Harry the overseer, a young white boy with more dirt in his pockets than money, pulled back on his horse's reins as he passed and circled around. His whip hung from the saddle, curled onto itself, the free tip flapping lazy in the wind. I hate that thing, James said. Afia didn't have to ask what he was talking about. And the soul who made it, too. It ain't the whip that keeps us slaves, she said. To them, the whip is everything. We is everything, Afia said. They went back to picking, because that's what they knew to do. The humid air was thick and hard to move through, but it was also good for conducting music. The crisp break of desiccated branches, the slap, slap, slap of brown, worn palms chasing elusive gnats, the drone of crickets shifting with the wind. The Negroes fell into its rhythm. It wasn't the song of Afia's ancestors, or even the song of freedom, but it took her places just the same. The woodchucks collected scraps all week to build a smoking pit after the new young Mr. Lewis took two slaves with him hunting in the woods, something his father would have never done. They came back with two hogs and a deer. Mr. gave them a quarter of one of the hogs to have all to themselves. After the daily cotton weighing, the Negroes gathered outside their cabins on the edge of the fields. They passed around a half-full bottle of whiskey made of soured corn. Just a swig made a Negro forget he was a slave, if only for the moment he felt the burn in his throat. "You gonna keep us waiting?" James said to George. The old Negro leaned his head to the side. He was half-deaf in one ear and all the way blind. He cradled a banjo made out of a hollowed gourd with fingers that had grapes for knuckles. "I wait for the music," George said. But his fingers started to strum at the strings. His grip found stead when he played, as if the instrument drank rheumatism in its notes. He plucked out a simple tune, low and sweet. The others jumped right into it. They made instruments out of whatever they could. Sticks resonated against cracked pottery jugs and glass bottles. Fork prongs scratched along the underbellies of rusted skillets. James even had a flute made out of reed cane. Its scraggly song against the rest simply belonged. Music was everybody's thing, even if it wasn't. Card players bobbed their heads as they brooded over their hands. The women hummed as they cut away the bottoms of pig feet, peeled potatoes, and shucked corn for the pit. Afia hummed a whisper as she stood at James's side. Sam, one of the field Negroes, had been keeping an uncomfortable eye on her. He came over. "I don't mean no disrespect," he said. He was tall and thin with bright, thoughtful eyes. "But I was just wondering if you can sing for us?" "You don't want to hear these pipes," Afia said. "I'm sure I do. If you're humming alone that sweet, I reckon your singing will set me free." "If only." Afia stood and went inside the cabin, James trailing behind her. I meant no offense," Sam's voice drifted after her. The taste of corn and potato and onion touched her nose. Two field Negro girls were cleaning pig intestines in a bucket of foul-smelling water. They had more of the pig to choose from, but they'd learned not to leave any of the animal to waste. "We almost done," Virginia said. She had gorgeous glassy eyes that looked like orbs floating in a sweet sea of mahogany. Her cheeks rose up tall when she smiled. She had hips Sophia secretly envied, with a backside that rested high and strong. "You all right?" James said. "Yes," Afia said. "I just needed a change of air is all." The music started up again. Sam sang. His voice was like the rattle of a wind catcher. "Your voice got to set us more free than that," James said. "I wouldn't know what to do with freedom," Afia said. "You ain't got to do anything with freedom. You just be it. Be free." James and Afia shared a cot in the corner of the cabin under the one window, which gave them a shadow's worth more of a privacy than the dozen other Negroes they lived with. "You going to become a freeman, old Mr. James?" Afia teased. "Nah, I'll keep the Hairston. Let them know I was born a slave, but I wasn't going to die one. Not by God I won't." This was a common topic with James, especially when he got drinking. Afia knew well enough not to push it further, but Mrs.'s slap still stung her cheek, even though her back felt nothing, not even an itch. Whispers were all it took to get a Negro's ear cut off, or worse. Afia was no stranger to freedom talk. Most spoke of it as some immaterial thing, like God in heaven. James believed he'd die a freeman. Afia couldn't help but trust him. "Imagine," he said, touching her belly, "me, you, the children, on a big span of land down in Florida. We ain't got children." "Not yet we don't." His hands found her neck. His lips melded to his. She pulled away. "I got something to tell you." "Tell me." He kissed her shoulder. She wanted to share her music, introduce him to her ancestors, but she was afraid. Young Mr. Lewis had been the last to hear her voice, back before their world had been torn into black and white, slave and slave master, since she'd kept that part to herself. "I love you," she said, and he said it back. It wasn't often they got time away from the fields and the other slaves to themselves. The music blessed them with cover. It guided them as they were still unused to each other's bodies. James was gentle. He had always been so. Still, Afia had to look past the pain left to her by a hasty childbirth to find pleasure. She didn't sing it away. She wouldn't dare. She wanted to be here fully for this, with him. His arms brought the only freedom she ever knew. No size chains could remove the memory they created, the feel of him inside her, the smell of cotton and dirt and sweat that was somehow made sweet, the loving hurt so different from what she found on the tip of a whip. They fell into each other, and in those moments, were free. Old Mr. Charles's whip had been insatiable. Afia often remembered a young Negro fresh from an Alabama auction block. He worked slow with clumsy fingers, and Mr. Charles thought he could beat speed into him. Afia found him on her way to the weighing shack, at the end of the day, lying beside a spilled bushel of cotton red with his blood. He had cut open his wrists with a piece of broken twig. The fear of the whip had gotten too much for him. It had been years since Afia had seen young Mr. Lewis, and back then he was only a boy, like she had been only a girl. She knew he didn't have his father's stone heart or his taste for blood, but all men live in their father's shadow. Even so, the fear of the whip wasn't enough to push them under the sun the next day. The song, like the laboring, was slow. Gnats followed Afia up and down the rows of cotton. She hummed, but her mind was in some other place. The sun had just fallen behind the Hairston attic, which menaced the field like an overseer, when Mr. Lewis came for her. She knew his smell better than she'd like. She looked around. Her husband was many lines down. Good. Miss Beatrice wants you, Lewis said. You got any idea why? No, sir, she said. She looked for a sign of the boy with whom she had shared part of her childhood. If he was there, Mr. Lewis hid it well. There had been a time not long ago when those eyes had been her refuge. She had felt special in a foolish kind of way, and when her belly was ripe with his child, she let herself believe things might change. He had been foolish, too, or the devil, because he'd tell her stuff like they had run away together to some place they could be. When old Mr. Charles saw Fia's daughter came out mulatto, he gave the newborn to Deborah, a young house slave rumored and fertile, and drove them both off to Alabama. He came back with three new slaves in their place. Afia never saw her daughter again. Mr. Charles made young Lewis give Afia 30 strikes and then sent him off to Uncle Willie's plantation in Virginia. The old man had sentenced Afia to death by whip, she was sure, but she had her song. Even with that, she'd been close to death for weeks. James, a field Negro, tended to her at night when old Lady Lily was too tired to keep vigil. Her song had saved her body. James had saved her spirit. She walked a few steps behind Mr. Lewis, head low like her mother had taught her when she was old enough to learn it. Her tattered shoes, the leather torn open at the toes, broke the parched dirt, blowing dust that smelled of heat up to billow around her. "Did you weep when Pa died?" Lewis said. "Yes, sir," she lied. "I didn't." "What does that mean?" "I don't know, sir." Miss Beatrice waited on the porch under the shadow of her sun hat. Her face was mean and narrow. She looked like she had never been under the sun and was angry at its existence. She stood as they climbed the stairs. Afia knew at once. Beatrice knew. She should have run off with James when Mr. Charles first died, when no one would have cared about a couple of lost field slaves. "Turn around," Miss Beatrice said. Afia did. Mrs. ripped the back of her shirt so hard the lines of linen cut beneath Afia's breast and across her ribs. "You see," Beatrice said, "your niggers play you for a fool." "I see a back that should be out in the fields," Mr. Lewis said. "Harry gave her 9 licks, and where is it? How's she gonna learn if she don't hurt?" Afia couldn't help it. "Scars ain't the only things that hurt," she said. She bit her lip. James would have scorned her for that, and he'd be right. "There she is, sassing me again. Not another word out of you," Lewis said to Afia. He turned to his wife. "If she got whipped, she got whipped. Ain't no more here to know. I don't know what kinds of tricks niggas got, but I know they tricks all the same. She was whipped once for foolishness. I won't do it again. She ain't learned, and that foolishness was yours," Lewis said. His wife stepped back as if slapped. My pa paid good money for work. You wasting work on feelings." Mr. Charles would spit in his grave if he knew his niggers were running his plantation. Lewis looked ready to hit Beatrice, and for a moment Afia thought he would. Instead, his face soured. He turned to Afia. "Go on out to the tree," he said. She wasn't afraid of the pain. She had her ancestors for that, but more what this would mean for the little boy she had come to both love and fear. "Go on now." Afia pulled her blouse up over her shoulders and slipped out from under Lewis and Beatrice. She hurried down the stairs, her feet against the floorboards, a germinating beat for the low hum in her throat. Her skin prickled with the protecting fingers of ancestral spirits. Deep drums and percussions only she heard cooled her against the summer sun. She was of two minds when her arms fell into the man-made grooves of the whipping tree. It had known many. In a few seconds, Lewis would unravel his whip and crack the air with its tip. Afia was already deep in her song, her temporary place of freedom. Somewhere far away, her flesh parted. The drums boomed louder. Afia's pitch rose. Her song kept in her blood, kept out her pain, protected her. "What in the hell are you doing, boy?" Lewis's voice pierced her shell like no braid of leather could. She whirled around, her world half music, half gnats and crickets and heat and the stink of fear. Lewis stood over fallen James, pointing a trembling pistol at him. For an impossible moment, the two had traded places. A fierce husband had the look of a crazed master, Lewis one of a scared runaway. She rushed over, wincing at the fire spreading across her back as the power of her song faded. "She ain't done a thing," James said. "You done lost it, boy?" Lewis said. Miss Beatrice came running down the stairs, her dress pulled high about her ankles. "Once a nigger attack you, he like a rabid dog." "My pa say the same," Lewis said without looking at her. His gun fixed, he nodded to Afia. "One of you got to explain yourself. This your husband?" "Yes, sir," she said. She steadied her voice. "He's just simple, real simple. That's all it is, Mr. Lewis." "I never took you to marry simple," Lewis said. "Mr. Charles, your pa made it so. He's simple, but he's strong, and our children gonna work these fields like none other." Too late, Afia saw this was the wrong thing to say. A flicker of the Lewis she'd known came through after all, just at the wrong time. A small crowd of Negroes and overseers watched from the edge of the field. Miss Beatrice stood waiting, her electricity hot on the air. "Now you go on, nigga," Lewis's voice broke as he said it. "You can clean her up after." Afia pleaded with James's eyes. He looked right back at her. He hated Lewis, just for what he hadn't done to save Afia from Mr. Charles. He couldn't get over his hate. He was stubborn like that. James turned and spit in Mr. Lewis's face. Lewis sighed long and deep. All eyes on him, waiting. The crickets held their song, waiting. The wind stilled, waiting. The whole plantation, it seemed, watched, waiting. "Get him up," Lewis told Harry the overseer, who was eager to oblige. He dragged the fighting James over to the whipping tree and pulled on a thick, low-hanging branch. "Put your hands up. Here, tie your fingers together." Mr. Lewis fastened James's wrists to the branch. He pulled up James's shirt and draped the bottom flap over his head. When James shook it off, Mr. Lewis whispered in his ear, and this time James didn't protest. "Please, mister, don't," Afia said. "He's my husband, my husband. I ain't got nothing else." "That nigga spit in my face," Lewis said. "I ain't got a choice." That first crack of the whip broke Afia more than any across her own back. She drew into herself with a panic mind that sent her skimming lost and blind across the ocean, searching for the sound of her ancestors. The beats of her own heart were disorienting waves against any path she could find. The part of her still on the plantation begged Lewis. He didn't listen, couldn't listen. She knew he couldn't, but she begged anyway. By the end of it, Lewis himself screamed with each blow. Sweat soaked the slave master's shirt and vest. His face burned red under the blood-orange sun. 39 lashes. Red dripped down James's buttocks, his legs, from his heels to mark the leaves and dirt and bits of torn cloth. He swung limp. Mr. left without a word. "All right," Harry said as he wound up the whip Lewis had left in the leaves. His hands went red. "Stop gawking and get back to work." He had a gleam in his eyes that Afia hated and remembered. Sam helped haul James back to the cabin. His teeth clattered together like the sound of twigs breaking. He shivered so bad. Old Lady Lily, an ancient Negro who never bore any children, but had been the best cook until she was too old to hold the skillet, packed James's back with salt and kept a cold, wet rag on his head to run away the fever. She rocked to one side as she hurried across the room. Her hip had gone bad years ago. "Protect him, Lord Jesus," she prayed over him. "Heal him, Lord Jesus." Afia sat with her husband's head in her lap. She tasted the salt of her tears and smelled the metal in his leaked blood, mixed with the lingering stench of pig intestines from the night before. "When I was real little," Afia said as she rocked him, "Ma said, we from a line of special folk. When something terrible happened, like war or famine, they sang themselves whole again, rebuilt the tribe, kept our history. didn't know what to do with a gift like that. I used it to heal Lewis one time when he hurt himself climbing a tree, and I was foolish and thought he'd think me special. I healed him, and he went and hurt me. I swore to keep my song to myself after that. James's eyes were closed in a shiver. His lips had gone pale. Afia kissed his forehead and started her song. She could see her land in the tune, but James was too heavy to carry through. "Sing with me," she said. "Please, James, I can't do this on my own." She pulled him close so some of the protecting warmth could spill over onto him, which wasn't enough. It had to be enough. The land of her ancestors opened up. They stepped through. James was so much easier to carry now, though Afia didn't know why. She didn't ask, only went forward further and further through a village of melodic, joyous spirits. The beats of drums, the hum of crickets, the click of tongues all carried her past familiar faces she had never seen in life. Her mother was there, as she had been for some years now, painting the sky golden with her voice. Afia realized James was no longer in her arms. He had walked forward along a path billowing dirt with the rhythm. He bent down and picked something out of the brown cloud and dusted it off. A flute. He tested its pitch, then began to play. Afia wanted to call to him to stop and stay and spend eternity singing to his tune, but the forward push of her ancestors was too strong. The flute's melody went soft and low, fading like a sunset. "Afia," a voice said. "Afia, he's gone, child. He's gone home to Jesus." She didn't open her eyes. She didn't want to see the color gone out of his face. Didn't want to lie and tell herself he looked like he was sleeping. "Go with my ancestors," she said, quiet enough so only she could hear, "and be free.
Didn't want to see the
sing it for me and for the rest of us." Afia laid James's head to rest on the dirt-caked floor as she rose on weak legs. His blood soaked her shirt and stuck cold against her skin, so different from the warm touch she'd now hold only in memories. She moved across the cabin. "Where you going, girl?" Virginia said. She was young and full of thoughts. "We got to get him ready." Old Lady Lily slapped Virginia upside the head with a wet towel. "Shush, you child. We got enough hands." Afia grabbed the crusted knife used to separate pig entrails from the stomach lining and slipped out of the cabin. The drone of crickets and the faraway song of bullfrogs walked Afia across the short road alongside the field up to the Hairston house. She went around past the weed-infested shed where the house Negroes lived and up to the back door leading into the kitchen. The click of the door behind her silenced the cacophonous night. She didn't dare sing or hum. Just breathing felt enough to betray her. Being inside these walls made the comfort of her ancestors fall away. Afia was alone. She floated upstairs and into the master bedroom. Beatrice slept with her eyes covered with some sort of mask, which baffled Afia. How could a slave ever hope to be free if she didn't even know what freedom was like? If she couldn't fathom being comfortable enough to sleep, even more blind to the world than usual. On the other side of Beatrice, Lewis slept quieter than Afia remembered. Back when they were teenagers, after the world had split them apart, but their harmony had remained naively monstrous. As he slept beside Afia in his bed, the air would whistle through his nose, and she'd touch her own and marvel at their difference. She feared old Mr. Charles would string her up from the rafters for every Negro to see if he knew, but somehow she felt safer with Lewis than out in the field of cotton and bullwhips and sad song. Part of that boy was here, but Afia couldn't see him. She could only hear the chittering of James's dying teeth. She never felt more like a slave, standing over him, knife in hand. Even if she killed him, his whiteness would live to determine her fate. She stood there for a long time. A white sheet in the shape of her dead husband was lying on the cooling board when she returned to the cabin. Afia put away the knife, unused, wiped her face of tears, and went to him. He smelled of soap and leaves and wool. "We going to be free," she said. "I promise."
When I was a little baby, my mother would rock me in the cradle in them old cotton fields at home. When I was a little bitty baby, my mother would rock me in the cradle in them old cotton fields at home.
You've been listening to Afia's song, or a section thereof, read for you by the author, Justin Key, over WBAI, New York. This is Odetta with Larry Moore.
It wasn't done in Louisiana, just a mile from Texarkana, in them all the cotton fields at home. It may sound a little funny, but you didn't make a very much money in them old cotton fields at home. It may sound a little funny, but you didn't make a very much money in them old cotton fields at home. Them cotton balls, they get rotten. Why, you can't pick very much of cotton in them old cotton fields at home. It was down in Louisiana, just a mile from Texarkana, in them old cotton fields at home. I was over in Arkansas, and the people would ask me what you come here for in them old cotton fields at home. I was over in Arkansas, and the people would ask me what you come here for in them old cotton fields at home. Oh, when them cotton balls they get rotten, you can pick very much of cotton in them old cotton fields at home. It wasn't down in Louisiana, just a mile from Texarkana, in them old cotton fields at home. When I was a little baby, my mother would rock me in the cradle in them old cotton fields at home. When I was a little bit of baby, my mother would rock me in the cradle in them old cotton fields at home. Oh, when them cotton balls get rotten, you can't pick very much of cotton in them old cotton fields at home. It wasn't down in Louisiana, just a mile from Texarkana, in them old cotton fields at home.
Ah, Odetta. If you don't know Odetta, fix that. She is amazing. She is absolutely amazing. And as I was saying to Justin, you know, that in some ways it almost seems trite, because the songs that she does, I mean, you know, performing Battle Hymn of the Republic, John Henry, and all that. This is almost, you know, everybody has done this at some point or another, but who is keeping it alive? And I'll tell you, there are some people who are doing this. There is a fabulous version of John Henry, done by, you're not going to believe this, Hugh Laurie.
Really?
Yeah, Hugh Laurie. That should appeal to the doctor in you, right? And
can I find it on YouTube?
Hmm?
Can I find it on YouTube?
You can. Probably. I think you can even find a video of it on YouTube. But if you want, but he does new instrumentations, mm-hmm. and he plays with the form and stuff like that. What she does is, well, not authentic. This isn't what people were doing in the fields. But the words are, the songs are. This is the folk version of that that brought these songs to the rest of the world. Thank you for that. Again, folks, that was a section of Afia's song. That's A-F-I-Y-A, Afia.
Yes.
Afia's song by Justin Key from the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, edited by C.C. Finley. Did he work on the story with you?
Yes.
Okay, and how was that experience? Well, sorry, I shouldn't ask that because there's only one possible answer you can give. It's an editor.
So it was a very good experience. And just as a background, I had been submitting to the magazine of fantasy and science fiction for a while, and I first had correspondence with Charlie when he was a guest editing an issue, I think, back in maybe 2015. And I sent him a story, and he gave me a very nice rejection for it. He held it to the end. It was actually the story that got me into the writing group, Tabula Rasa, in terms of, like, the story that I sent them in terms of, like, a sample of my writing. And he really, you know, he really liked it. But, you know, in the end, he said that I held it till I had this issue done. And that was the first thing he had seen from me. And since, you know, I'd been sending him stories over the years, and he said, you know, I think you have a lot of potential. I think you're going to blow me away one day, you know, but it was these, you know, nice rejections.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's the thing. I was a rejection writer at Galaxy Magazine in its penultimate days, working for Jim Bain. And you don't have time to write a personal, you know, this show's potential, keep at it. And there are only a certain percentage of stories that I would pass on to Bain as the editor. Otherwise, I would make, you know, when I, you know, any story that started out with ends, and, you know, it's like, next, mm-hmm. you know, getting, you know, pink slip and on to the next. Actually, they were blue, but you get the idea. When an editor does what Charlie Finley did for you, writing notes of encouragement, and FNSF has been great about this.
Yeah.
Gordon Van Gelder always took out the time whenever he saw something worthwhile, and Charlie Finley also has that reputation of being very encouraging when he sees talent, even if it's not the story he wants.
Right.
And he's going to pass on it. He says, you know, keep sending us stuff.
It had a very good impact on me, you know, and it felt like I had someone out there who was taking notice of the writing that I was doing, even if it wasn't published, you know, even if it wasn't getting published, it was encouraging to keep doing it. And I remember when I was at Clarion West, and so I wrote this story, I think, week four, for Nalo. And then actually a little bit later, when Cory Doctorow came on, we had already workshopped the story, but he read it and he was very encouraging about it. And he said, you know, you need to send this out to like the top places now, you know? And the first place that I thought of was a magazine of fantasy and science fiction, because, you know, I felt like I would really get a good look at it. And also how encouraging Charlie had been to me, you know, I felt like that's where I wanted the home for it to be. And it worked out. You know.
Yeah, no, that's a great, that's a great sale.
Yeah,
it really is. The online magazines of today, like Tor.com and Clark's World and Lightspeed, which with whom I am affiliated as the host of the Lightspeed magazine podcast, and I do, I audio edit the podcast that is produced by Stefan Rudnicki and Skyboat Media. That's one great market, but the print market is still there, and is, you know, there are special anthologies that come out, some from cross genres, and cross genres at this point. They're not doing regular magazine at this point, are they?
They aren't.
They're just occasionally, very rarely, putting out books.
Right.
And Mike Allen has Mythic Delirium and puts out the Clockwork Phoenix books. But outside of that, you still have Analog, Asimov's, and FNSF, which is short for the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. And so getting into one of those three is, I don't know why it feels more right. Oh, and now, of course, Omni magazine is back.
Oh.
But Omni's a quarterly so far. Give it time, and I'm sure we'll, it'll come into its own.
Yeah, it's been a great experience for me, and it's kind of been, you know, very surreal, you know, having my story in print in a magazine that's been around for so long, that's been the home of so many amazing writers and amazing stories. And it feels like, even if I don't, you know, obviously I'm continuing writing, I'm working on stuff now, but, you know, even if I didn't do anything else, I could say, I, you know, I have this story that was very important to me in a magazine where it's going to reach people that I wouldn't have reached otherwise. So it feels very good.
Now, how, what, in, I mean, to say what inspired that story is a stupid question almost. Because the story itself answers that question.
Right.
But how many generations has your bloodline, has your family been in the U.S., and was there slavery in your family?
There was, and my family's, so my name is Justin Key, but my mom's name is Pamela Hairston, and so we are descendants
I noticed
of,
the name Hairston, and no relation to Andrea.
No.
Okay.
No, well, at least I don't think so. You know, sometimes...
Well, Andrea will be in town in May, performing at the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading, so we can ask her then. Yeah.
And so we are descendants of, I believe, was it... It might be, I believe it's a George Henry plantation. And it's a very interesting tidbit. Recently, I found online, and I was actually able to find... a registry where I was able to track from my grandfather back up to the slaves that were at the George County Plantation, I believe in North Carolina. So, yeah, so that's my mother's side. I'm not as sure about my father's side, but, you know, we've my mother was born in Southern Virginia, in Martinsville, Virginia.
Born into slavery, I assume?
Huh? My mother was
oh,
born...
Oh, your mother.
No,
not,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, sorry. No, my mother was born into was born in Southern Virginia, and that's where her family's from. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of Hairstons there, and I believe that, that in that area is where my family roots in terms of in America are from. And my mom moved out to Washington, D.C., and that's where I grew up. But my main family is from Southern Virginia. So,
and what do you know of the facts of the slavery in your family? How far back do the stories go? I come from a Holocaust family, and I don't actually know a good deal. My grandparents didn't survive the Holocaust. My mother and father did, through each one through remarkable circumstances. So I actually don't have that much of a sense of a family history. I think my older brother does. So you know, horrid tragedies like this can curtail knowledge of, kinship, kindred, to use Octavia Butler's language there, which is so important.
You know, and at times the knowledge can be, I'd say, very fragmented in terms of, you know, knowing exactly what the lineage is, and in terms of what the stories of my grandmother's grandmother was. I think what I've heard from my family is, I believe my grandmother's grandmother was born into slavery.
Mm.
And I think that that was the most recent. You know, mostly the stories that I've, you know, heard growing up, where it's been passed down, is from my grandma growing up in Southern Virginia. And my mom was born in 1954. And, you know, being a child in the Jim Crow South and still remembering the signs of, you know, whites only or blacks only. And also, you know, how progressively, you know, my mom's mom worked house cleaning as a maid her whole life, you know, and was very, very much wanted to instill the importance of education to her children, even though she didn't have much of that opportunity herself, you know. And it's been incremental in terms of, you know, my mom was able to go to college, and I'm the first person in my family to go to medical school, and hopefully I won't be the last. You know, it's you know, but being that, it being the first of that, it becomes scary, you know, in terms of kind of setting foot into that which your family hasn't done yet.
Scary and prideful at the same time, I would think.
I try not to be, but it is. I mean, I my mom is she has enough pride for both of us when it comes to me, so I let her have all of it.
That's good. Yeah.
But I try to,
you but know, my, yeah. Scary. I know what you mean. I'm talking to a psychiatrist here, so I'm going to tell him how he feels, right? I would think struck with awe.
Yeah.
I don't want to say awestruck because that's an overused word, but struck with awe at the fact that you are the first in this. It's horrifying and wonderful, I would think.
Yeah.
I shouldn't speak for you, of course, but it's the sense that I get. There's a thrill that this can happen, and at the same time, it's a horror that it had to be this way.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that's accurate.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, it's also, you know, with certain successes comes responsibility of having the right narrative. And I think that's something that I try to be mindful of in terms of, you know, not using my success to necessarily say that someone else who doesn't have the same path as me, not using my success to say, well, they should be able to do it too. Because I've also been very mindful of how fortunate I've been in terms of the upbringing that I had and the opportunities that I had, where I've seen people around me not have the same type of opportunities, who, to be honest, were harder workers than me at times, or even smarter than me at times, and just sometimes kind of having that perfect combination or not so perfect combination. So just kind of trying to keep those things in mind and trying to let my success be kind of a narrative for where this country has come from, but where it still needs to go, as opposed to being used as a narrative, oh, everything's okay now, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. And especially this scary time in the country, because it looked for a while that we'd taken one giant leap forward, now two giant leaps. I won't say backward, I'll say downward.
Yes.
Downward seems
fell
to
in a
be.
Pit.
Yeah, a pit that was filled.
Yes.
Filled
with tweets, and I won't get into it.
Yeah, no, that's enough. I think people get it.
Yeah.
But Nevertheless, we persist. To paraphrase another part of the resistance.
I will say that, you know, the genesis for this story, I think a few years ago I had a thought about a protagonist who was able to heal themselves. And I was trying to think about, like, what different settings this may be, like, it could be used in. And I forget exactly at what point, you know, it came up in terms of trying to use it in a story that was linked to my heritage, but I had it in the back of my mind. And I tried to write a few pages of it a few years ago and felt like I wasn't ready to write it yet. I kind of put it aside. I knew I would come back to it. When I got accepted to Clarion West, and I was thinking about, okay, you know, are there ideas that I have going in? Because at Clarion West, they really encourage you not to bring trunk stories from, that you can have ideas, but start from the beginning. And I followed that. So all the things that I wrote there was from scratch, but I had some ideas. And this was one of those ideas that was kind of playing in my head, and it morphed while I was at Clarion. Because I remember originally I had the protagonist being a male protagonist. And at Clarion, one of the issues that came up was the portrayal of women in fiction.
Yeah.
And I actually realized that in some of the slave narratives that were recently popular in theaters, for example, 12 Years a Slave and Django, the representation of women in those movies, they were really used as tragic figures. Like, if you look at in 12 Years a Slave, the main woman character in the movie was mainly there to show just the tragedy of slavery, and in the end, she also met a tragic fate, and there was no kind of redemption for her. She didn't have any autonomy in that. And then the same if you look at Django, the woman character slave in that movie was, you know, for lack of a better phrase, it was used as like a motivation for the main character to, you know, to basically kind of lead this tirade against the slave owners. So that was one of the things that I was challenged at in my mind based on how the feedback from my classmates for other stories that we were seeing there, and trying to think, okay, maybe I can actually add something, you know, to the what I've seen in slave narratives. And another thing that I was thinking about in the time is that in both of those stories, you had this idea of the white savior, which felt like it was needed. You know, in 12 Years a Slave, you had the Brad Pitt's character who kind of came out of nowhere and says, like, I'll get you out of here. And you had a similar character in Django. And this story, actually, you might have not gotten it from me reading it, but it's also alternate history. And it's an origin story of a slave rebellion and where the slaves free themselves under being led by Afia. And then what does that look like? And actually, there's some snippets, some interludes of people many years after slavery reflecting on the Great War that freed the slaves. And I didn't read them in the reading here because it'd be a little confusing. But when you read it in the text, it's very demarcated and clear, and kind of puts a context into the rest of the story. And in terms of like what Afia is going through, where she ends up. And I think gives it a little bit greater meaning in that. And I think that's the beauty also of speculative fiction, is being able to kind of take these elements and see how they may be different, and be able to pull something that says something about the human spirit, and also has commentary a little bit on, you know, things that are happening now, or making people think about, you know, what does this say about the society we live in now?
Yeah. a ton of questions come to mind about a lot of that. One is, you know, with the white savior, when you think of movies like Cry Freedom and things like that, where in order to tell the story of Steve Biko, we have to have, Kevin Kline or whatever. And yes, on the one hand, that's problematic. On the other hand, who's going to the movies at that time?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not talking about who's going to fund it. Not, you know, because they're all looking for their dollar bills and stuff like that. And they're going to say, well, white audiences are going to be the one. But nevertheless, sometimes you need, this is an argument, and I'm not going to say I am right. I have a question. Might that be under certain circumstances giving people a gateway character, a way that white people can come into the story, and now that you are in there, look around and see what the circumstances are. I'm probably wrong. In fact, I'm going to say I'm probably wrong, but the thought occurs to me.
I think this is what
landed in my brain. That's all.
I think that in terms of the viewers going to see movies, that's probably a lot of what drives a lot of the decisions that's made in movie making. I will say that one of the
producer's decision is about butts and seats.
Yeah.
It doesn't go beyond that.
One of the things that, I thought in 12 Years a Slave that was already there is you already kind of have the setup to bring people into the narrative, because you start off with someone who is not a slave, was not born a slave, is free. And I thought in that sense, you can already kind of, even as me who's removed from slavery, like relate to the horror of that. You know, it's kind of in the same light of, and it's still, I think, kind of unfortunate part of like the human psyche, but it seems more tragic to us when someone who is, well off then ends up homeless versus someone who's already homeless who just continues to be homeless. It seems like more of a tragic thing to look how far they've fallen, or I could have been that as well. So I think that factor may have already been in that movie. So later it almost kind of felt like how it was done, I think, in that movie was literally like, nothing works. Let's put in Brad Pitt to come save the day. Which, I felt like in that movie that you might have already had an element that maybe not by the skin color, but that people who weren't descended of slaves or don't have that narrative.
Caucasian ex machina.
Yeah. Could still say, I could see how this would be horrible.
Yeah.
So that was something that in that light, I thought that they could do without, particularly in that movie. I think that it was less strong.
Because that movie, your gateway character is the Chiwetel. I never know how to pronounce his last name.
I'm the worst with names, so don't even ask me.
But he already is the gateway character.
Yeah.
And he's as good a gateway character to white people because he's educated, because he's free man, because he's got all the rights in the world, and all of a sudden it's slapped away.
Yeah.
It's just taken away. And so you don't need a different gateway character. Good God, Hamte, how the bleep are you? And so it certainly works there, but there are other characters that make it wonder, but also that's a true story, largely a true story. There are people who actually challenge the narrative that the guy wrote, although there are people who defend it at the same time. But it's removed, okay? That first it's put down in autobiographical form, then it's put into a movie by people who cannot call it an autobiography. So there are issues there. But when it comes to the written word, to fiction, it's easier to write the other, isn't it? Especially speculative fiction, when you're supposed to not only come up with human beings with whom you do not have a direct connection, but you're also supposed to come up with aliens to whom you have no connection whatsoever. Has anybody asked you how it was to write your lead character from the perspective of a woman?
I can't remember if anyone has asked me.
Then that might as well be no.
And I'm thinking you're asking me that now?
No.
No.
No, I'm asking if you have been challenged. I am not challenging you. I have no problem with it at all. Some of the best women characters have been written by people in science fiction have been written by people like John Varley. And even to a very limited extent, Robert Heinlein, who's also written some of the worst women in brainy but busty kind of things. But if they're young girls or older women outside of the age of menstruation, he could write great women. He really could. And as protagonists, Podcane of Mars, for example. So, no, I'm asking, has the issue come up, not whether you have been
presented
with it.
And it was actually, you know,
I'm in support of people trying to write the other. Yeah. That's what if.
Yeah. It hasn't come up after the fact. It was actually originally the opposite. I think before someone, Lori Penny actually, who was one of my classmates at Clarion West, you know, after my first couple stories, she said, you know, I'd like to see you, you know, try a female lead character, a woman lead character, and see, you know, how that feels. And I think there is something about writing the other that makes you a lot more aware of how you characterize them, the issues that come around, the thing that may define that other, that if they're side characters, you may not be as in tune to it or may not be invested in making sure that those things are done right. But when it's your main character, I think that you're, especially with a story like this, you just had to be very careful with, you know, how I portray things and what are the things that I'm trying to say and what are the things that I'm trying to add. And really quick, one example of that is also, you know, in one issue, for example, in the...
By the way, you're not going to believe what I'm about to say, but we're going to have to start wrapping up because we actually ended 8 seconds ago. I mean, we're not off the air, but I've got the outro music queued up so that we're going to end at 3 a.m. And it's horrifying because we could go another hour easily. But Habte Selassie is here, who I followed. How many years did I follow you? About 10 years at least.
At least.
And it was a delight. And, well, I miss seeing Lister this morning. It's wonderful to see you. Let me put you on camera. We're on Facebook Live here.
So. After the change, this is what he looks like.
Yeah, right. Listen, let me outro.
Okay.
My guest this morning has been Justin Key, K-E-Y. When's your next piece coming out?
Well, hopefully... I'm very hopeful, and I've gotten very encouraging feedback. Hopefully, I'll have some news about a novel sometime next year.
A novel, okay.
And I can say that with a bit of confidence. It feels like things are going the right direction with that. But okay. We have to see.
That's great news, and you'll be back here, and maybe at the reading series as well. So this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for watching on Facebook. You can keep on doing that because we're going to keep that live there. And stay tuned for, is it Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Habte Selassie coming your... Yeah, well, he always adds the clapper to it. So, but that's Lister, one of the most strange and wonderful people in the world. Have a good morning, everybody. Please.
please be good to each other. Take care.
Hey, this is Bernie Ledden. You're listening to WBAI, listener-supported radio in New York City.
Ninety-9.5 FM, WBAI New York. It is coming up on 2 minutes after 3 o'clock, I should say, on WBAI.org by way of the internet. Hour of the Wolf will be back next week with the same host, Jim Freund. And good morning to one and all, to each of you. A personal good morning. My name is Habte Selassie. We are sitting in this morning for Lister. This is Burn Baby Burn for Thursday, November 30th, 2017. Okay, 2017. So, I like to say, just in case you've been a long-time listener, or even a new listener to Lister and Burn Baby Burn. If you're not from Jamaica, not from England, and you heard reggae music in the United States for the first time, that is the first time you heard reggae music was in the United States and you were not in the home of a Jamaican, Lister is the reason why you did, okay? We just want to make sure of that. And can we do this? One of the things that he promoted.
vibration, yeah.
Positive.
Got to have a good vibe.
I am an Irishian, yeah.
Irish-ites.
Whoa, whoa. Positive vibration, yeah.
Positive.
If you get down and you quarrel every day, one another on the way,
make it much easier,
just
yeah,
a little bit, yeah, easier. Say you just can't live that negative way, if you know what I mean, make way for the positive day, cause it's news, news and days. And if it's a new feeling, look at it, said it's a new sign. Oh, what a new day.
Same job. take us out of homeland. You take us down here in Babylon. You wanted us to sing that same song. You wanted us to sing that same song. You wanted us to sing that same song. And I know we all gonna jam the same jam. We all gonna chop the same chop. So if you argue, fuss and fight, you're giving hypocrites the right to say that we can't unite. My God, I know we can't fight. Oh, we all gonna sing the same song. We all gonna jam the same jam. We all gonna chop the same chop. Chop. We all gonna chop the same chop. We all gonna jam the same jam.
Come along, my brother, come along. Let us do the things we're supposed to do for our mother. Come along, my sister, come along too. But if we should live up in the, 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 live up in the.
And if we should live up in the
year. Up in the hills, the hills.
And if we should live up in the hills.
My brother, go, go to the river to carry the water, the water. My sister wash up the dishes. She even goes to the shop. When my smaller brother run around and pick up the bramble to keep the fire blazing, to keep my fire blazing, blazing fire, fire.
And if we should live up in the hills,
and if we should live up in.